So the project one is returned. The TA is going to send a mail with the statistics. The basic idea seems to be that most of you got on the required part 90 or above. Okay, so this is the way the projects normally are. I mean, the people who wind up doing it do fine, and the people who haven't gotten their things to work have trouble. So he did probably not take away points this time around if you didn't do as good a job of analysis, but he's likely to be more strict on it next time. Also, some of you have sort of the coding issues too. He made comments on how to, you know, make sure that the code is general, that he did not take away points this time, but you're likely to pay for it more next time. But he also would send mail about his observations as well as the statistics on that. There are four people, I think two from 471 and two from 598 section, who would have in red, red ink, a request saying that if you're interested, send me your report and then we'll put it up on the web. Okay, so those are the four projects that seemed exemplary in the sense they did everything and they also have good analysis, etc. Yes, sir. You can send it to me or the TA and then it'll wind up appearing on the homepage. Okay. The 471 students have not actually done as much on the extra credit stuff. The 598 students, several of them did all the extra credit plus more, which is probably not surprising given that there's more time for the 598 students. That's why you are in different equivalence classes. But I still would have liked to see some 471 students do extra credit stuff. It would have been interesting to see. So when I put, that's part of the reason why we are just picking two from each rather than just the best project overall, because I realized that there are two groups of students taking this course. Okay. Any questions? Yes, sir.
I have a question on the homework.
Okay.
Diagonal. Does that mean, what do you mean by that? Does that mean diagonal per cell? Like if you're cell 3-1, you want the diagonal from that guy and that?
What is this question on? I mean, you have to remind me what the homework problem was.
Oh, it's a
Sudoku, yeah. So that the diagonal constraint normally is the main diagonal constraint.
Just the main diagonal.
Yeah. So not all other constraints. Only the main diagonals must have different numbers. I believe so. I mean, this is a project, not the homework, right?
Yeah, it's a project.
It's a project, yeah. But I meant the, it's the main diagonal. I think it is both. I'll check for making sure. But definitely, it's not any possible small diagonal. It's only the main one.
Uh-huh. We've been asked that in one of the test cases that we gave the results using MRV LCV but not forward checking. But then if you don't use forward checking, how do I select my leads?
Because you can always, essentially it's a static ordering then. So minimum remaining values, you know, if you don't do forward checking, then minimum remaining values induces an ordering from the beginning itself. Okay? So, and you just use that all the time. Mm-hmm.
But when I make an assignment to a variable, I'm supposed to update its neighbors. Like I should take a
If you update, then you're doing forward checking.
Yes.
If you don't have to do that. See, I mean, it's a program. You get to decide which part you want to do. The point is that most constrained variable are MRV, minimum remaining values. Heuristic is, in essence, you know, is actually an idea which doesn't always have to go with forward checking. Of course, if they go together, they are much more useful than if they go separate. Okay, that was the point that we are asking you to do. Okay, if you just use minimum remaining values and don't do forward checking, versus if you do forward checking and, you know, do the ordering with the minimum remaining values, which keeps changing because as you propagate the constraint, the domains become smaller and smaller.
So when we're doing minimum remaining value, we don't update those.
See, you can say that the minimum remaining values keeps track of the current list of values per variable. If you don't do forward checking, the current list of values per variable remains the same all through the search.
Mm-hmm.
If you do forward checking, it changes.
Okay,
that's it. Okay, so these are all flags. You can put forward checking yes, no, and you know you can get, and you will see that forward checking plus MRV do much better than just MRV, for example.
Also, like the least constraining value, I mean, how do I select it? Do we select it? It's a bit open to interpretation. Like, either I could select the value which strikes out the least number of its neighbors or the value.
So that in general, both of these actually are both the most constrained variable and the least constraining value are open to interpretation. So I'm asking you to use the interpretation that you use in the text, but the most constrained value, which is where we call it MRV, which is already a specific interpretation of most constrained value. Think about all most constrained variable. Okay, what the most constrained variable is essentially the variable that is most constrained. Okay, how do you decide what is most constrained? You can say a variable which has the least number of remaining values is most constrained. Okay, or you can say the variable which is taking part in constraint with the most number of remaining variables is most constrained. And those are two different interpretations. Okay, and similarly, least constraining value also can have multiple interpretations. In the case of for this project, actually, I think it's fine. For example, MRV, which looks at most constrained variable as the variable with the least number of remaining values, it makes not as much sense if you were to do this for SAT problems. For example, because SAT problems always have 0, 2, or 1 values. So in fact, in the case of SAT problems, we did consider, in the last class I mentioned that there is this solver called SAT-Z, which essentially did, what did we say, it essentially did for each of the variables, V1, it considers setting V1 to true, V1 to false, doing unit propagation here, doing unit propagation here, and seeing how small the theory becomes when you do unit propagation. Okay, and pick the variable that winds up doing the maximum amount of unit propagation. That essentially, in essence, is capturing the variable that is connected to most other variables in a useful way. Because the only reason unit propagation would have occurred and the remaining theory would have become smaller is if, in fact, this variable winds up taking part in constraints with lots of other variables. Okay, so SAT-Z does variable ordering heuristic, which is still can be seen as most constrained variable, but it's not minimum remaining values. It is the one that winds up actually taking part in the most number of constraints and makes most amount of unit propagation go. Okay, so I was giving you more than what you asked for. One is that in general, most constraint variable is an idea that can be operationalized in multiple ways. In the simple CSP solver, just look at it as minimum remaining values. If you want to try other ideas, that's fine too. Okay? And similarly, for the least constraining value, I believe the text actually has one specific interpretation. That's the only thing I want you to do, which is the one with respect to which rest of the variables wind up having, least constraint. I don't quite remember what specific interpretation the text has, but I gave you a number, page number. That's the only interpretation I want you to actually interpret. Okay, but there are many other ways of doing it. Okay. Other question? Okay. So what I'm going to do today is go through a few loose ends of the propositional entailment and then go into probabilistic propositional reasoning. Okay. So as I mentioned last time, any sound and complete inference procedure. So inference entailment is part of the conjugate of model finding. So first of all, right? If you, in model finding, you're saying given a bunch of SAT classes, is there a model? In entailment, what you're saying is, if I want to say that these classes will entail this sentence, then I can negate this sentence, add it to these classes, and show that there is no model. Okay? So entailment involves showing that the theory, a specific theory, is not satisfiable. So it's kind of the conjugate problem of showing that a theory is satisfiable. Okay? And so in fact it's co-NP complete, because we know satisfiability problems are NP complete. Okay? Of that, but there are ways in which you can consider subsets of this entailment, parts of the entailment which are actually tractable. Okay. For example, if it turns out, for example, if you do resolution, if you just do all the sentences that are entailed by modus ponens, for example, no resolution, just the modus ponens rule, okay, that is guaranteed to be polynomial time inference. Okay, which actually also means that modus ponens cannot prove every theorem that is actually provable, because something has to give, right? I mean, if you're only computing, modus ponens can compute whatever it can compute in polynomial time, and if I'm telling you that computing entailment in general is co-NP complete, then modus ponens must be missing something. And what it misses, for example, is this case analysis that we talked about. Okay. Similarly, you can also compute everything that is computable through modus tollens in polynomial time. Okay, a more general, so modus ponens and modus tollens can both be computed in polynomial time. And they are a different sort of an inference that in fact we used in the Davis-Putnam procedure is just unit resolution. Okay, so resolution is a general case of both modus ponens and modus tollens. Because resolution does modus ponens, it does modus tollens, it also does disjunction. It also basically does the case analysis. Okay. However, there is a different way of specializing resolution, which is unit resolution. And what unit resolution is what we talked about last time, which is resolve a pair of classes such that one of them is always unit length, and keep doing it until you no longer can derive any new sentences. Okay, that is obviously sort of what unit resolution is doing, is some of the modus ponens, some of the modus tollens, not all of modus ponens, because modus ponens does not have to have, it doesn't have to be just unit resolution. One of the classes doesn't always have to be unit. So it does some of modus ponens, some of modus tollens, but it is polynomial. Okay, and we actually use that as part of the Davis-Putnam procedure, because we did some inference to prove to ourselves that this theory cannot have solution. And if you couldn't, then you use the amount of inference you've done to either order the variables or just go forward on. So for example, when you set a variable to be true, then when you did unit propagation, you were able to realize that some other variables either have no more values left, in which case you could backtrack right away, are that they are forced to have certain values, in which case, in some sense, you had a cascaded set of assignments. Okay, so that's basically the complexity of the inference in the classes. This class, actually, Hahn clauses, the ones, so by the way, Hahn clause is a clause which the way to describe that is, if you were to convert a sentence S into its CNF form, okay, it will be a bunch of clauses, right? A clause would be literal 1 or literal 2 or literal 3 and so on, okay? And a clause is called a Hahn clause if it has at most one positive literal, at most one positive literal. A clause is called a Hahn clause if it has at most one positive literal. And for example, if I have A and B implies C, if I convert it into a clausal form, it will be not A or not B or C. is that Hahn clause or not? Is it Hahn or not?
Yes.
Yes, because it has exactly one. So it is. It does have at most one. Okay. How about A? Is that a Hahn clause? Yes. How about A and B? Is that a Hahn clause? A and B, because it's a Hahn clause, because A and B really are two clauses, A and class A and class B. It's a Hahn clause too. So what is not a Hahn clause? A or B. It's not a Hahn clause. What you're doing is you're ignoring, you're trying to stop disjunction from creeping in. What Hahn clauses do is to stop disjunction from coming in. And you remember I mentioned that the thing that makes theorem proving hard is the case analysis. Okay, remember that, you know, what is justified if WMDs are found, what is justified if WMDs are not found is what's justified. And it involved two cases, and you had to prove that in both cases what is justified, so it's justified. Because Hahn clause is a, you know, a theory, so a sentence is considered a Hahn sentence if when you convert it into clausal form, each of the clauses have at most one positive literal. At most one positive literal. A clausal form is a CNF form. So each clause is a disjunction of literals. And A or B already is positive A and positive B. And similarly, the other thing, of course, is if you have A and B implies C or D, that too would be a non-Hahn clause. How about A and B implies C and D? That's Hahn clause, because A and B implies C and D can actually be written as A and B implies C, A and B implies D, and those two are Hahn clauses. Okay, so really what Hahn clauses try to do is to capture the part of the world of logical sentences which don't have real disjunction. Okay, if you don't have real disjunction, then you can run modus ponens and get everything that comes out, everything that is entailed. So if I know for sure that my logical database is Hahn clauses, is fully Hahn clauses, then everything entailed by this knowledge base is also derived by modus ponens. So if alpha is entailed by the knowledge base, then it's also derived by the modus ponens. This only happens for the Hahn clauses. If the knowledge base has non-Hahn clauses, then there may be sentences that are entailed but are not derivable. Okay? And Hahn clauses are useful subset of the clauses, because for that you can do this efficient modus ponens based reasoning. And modus ponens based reasoning is actually very natural for us to understand, because there oftentimes isn't too much of a, you know, there is no case analysis that you wind up doing. So for example, you can say A and B implies C, M implies A, N implies B, M is true, N is true. Is C true? I can just prove this by modus ponens, right? This and this will let me prove A, this and this will let me prove N, sorry, let me prove B, and A and B together let me prove C, using just modus ponens. Okay? And the language prologue that all of you, several of you probably heard of from 240, essentially does Hahn clause theorem proving for first order logic, not propositional logic, but first order logic. Which should make you wonder. Prolog is supposed to be a full programming language. Full programming language should be Turing complete. Right? And if in fact it's only doing modus ponens, what happens? It cannot actually be doing anything more than polynomial type computation. Turns out that Prolog has this cut operator, for example, which winds up changing the semantics. So if you don't have cut operator in the prologue, then it is pure Hahn clause theorem proving. And then it would be polynomial. Yes, sir?
Would you say that
cut operator. Yeah. We'll talk about prolog, and in fact, you probably will wind up writing your own prolog interpreter as one of the projects once you do first order logic. Okay. But it's nice to know that Hahn clauses are directly connected to prolog in the first order case. Okay. And that there is a reason why Hahn clauses are defined that way. I mean, upfront it looks weird. Why is it that you're defining Hahn clauses as a clause which has at most one positive literal? That's because I want to be able to say this is fine, 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 even M and N is fine. Okay, and also A and B implies C and D is also fine. What I don't like is things like A or B. And that's the easiest way to define, away the part that you don't like. Yes?
Not the same thing to write A and then another clause B.
Yeah, that's the point. So A or B is not at all, So when you have a set of CNF clauses in your knowledge base, if I have A and B in the knowledge base, that means both A is true and B is true. So you have to have a convention. The convention is that every sentence in your knowledge base must be true. Okay, which means there is an implicit conjunction across all the sentences. Okay, that's why if what you want to say is A or B, you have to write A or B. You can't get to write A separately and B separately. Okay, so that's the kind of nice thing that, Hahn clauses have this thing, and this is a tractable class. Okay, and in fact, if you are writing a theorem prover, it becomes easier to write a theorem prover for Hahn clauses, because you can almost start from what you want to prove and decide what needs to be proved. So for example, if I had A and B implies C, M implies A, N implies B, M is true, N is true, okay, and is C true? Suppose this is what I asked, okay? I can do it actually in a fairly obvious way. Start from trying to prove C. C can be proved if there is a C already in the database, or there is a rule whose head is C. So there is a rule here. So then I try to say, well, I can prove C if I can prove A and B. Now A can be proved if A is there or there is a rule. And I can prove A by proving M, I can prove B by proving N. M is actually true, N is actually true, so this is done, this is done, this is done. Normally, there is still a search involved in this, because suppose I had one more sentence saying P and Q also implies C, but I won't say that P and Q are true. Maybe I'll even make you go around and say P implies Q, Q implies P. I have these sentences in my thing. So now what would I do when I start trying to prove C? I will have to first decide which rule to work on. Now as long as, remember that a theorem is provable if there exists a proof. A theorem, it doesn't become unprovable because you tried for 3 minutes and you couldn't prove it. Right? So it turns out that C, when you're doing it this way, you could go from C here and try to do it as P and Q, or go this way and try to do it as A and B. It turns out that this thing will never go anywhere. And in fact, if you do depth first search, which is what prolog does, it can even go into cycles, because it will try to prove P by saying, well, I can prove P by doing Q, and then I can do Q by doing P, do Q, P, and so on. So you have to put a depth limit to get out of that bad branch. But this branch will go fine. Okay?
Real quick, why doesn't prolog implement like a parent check to see if...
Yeah, in fact, it does all sorts of things. It also allows you to do cut, which is actually you telling prolog when to start backtracking and not going to cycle. Okay? But it's interesting. So the point is that you notice that this particular theorem prover that I just told you, by the way, this is going to be the first part of that prolog project where you do a propositional prolog first. And I'll give you the code for that. And it's just a very simple code because it essentially goes through the list of rules, looking at what it's trying to prove, look for a rule whose head is what it's trying to prove, and then subgoal on the tail. Okay? And then do this recursively until you have proved everything that you needed to prove. Okay? Now, the problem, of course, is that if you're doing it this recursive way, you may go into cycles in some directions. And you need to get out of those cycles. And the normal way you can stop going into cycles is put a depth limit or something and say, if I cross that depth limit, I just kill that branch and go to a different branch. Okay, but had you done something like a depth first search, you would still have found this. Right? You do depth, if you did breadth first search, you would have found it. You do want to implement depth first search because it's so much easier to implement. It takes much less space. It would only remember one line of argument at a time. Okay? So prolog interpreters and also doing theorem proving just by model exponents is very easy to understand. Yes, sir. There are many other things. Yes, that's possible. It is possible, and that you could try to figure out which class to pick first. But it turns out that there are all sorts of interesting issues. In fact, once you throw in variables, which is what happens in first order logic, right? Then you may wind up having all sorts of interesting issues. Even if you have P and Q, right? One of the things that will happen when you get to first order logic is you're trying to prove C of X for some particular X. Okay? And then you'll try to prove that there is a P of X and Q of X holds for that X. Now, whatever is the thingy for which P of X holds, that is the thingy for which you have to prove Q of X. So there is a sideways passing of information in the proof tree because of the variable. So in such cases, the order in which you work on the variable, the subgoals winds up becoming important. Okay? The order in which you work on subgoals becomes important. And depending on the world in which you live in, it may be one order is better than the other order. So suppose if you are trying to find, let's say, a person is a good friend if they are alive and they are smart, let's say. I made this rule up. Okay, so do you prove that they are alive first or they are smart first? In most normal world, everybody is alive. Many of them are not smart. So for everybody, you pick up saying, hey, they're alive, not smart, alive, not smart. Okay, so in the normal world, it makes sense to first prove smartness and then check if they're alive. If you are sitting in a morgue, on the other hand, it makes more sense to check they're alive first and then trying to prove their smartness. Okay. So again, all these kinds of interesting questions can come in. But the bigger point I want to make is this theorem proving is, you can do it top down and it's quite easy. As compared to the full theorem proving, which is including the resolution. Okay, in resolution, remember I showed this example last time where I had to prove it was raining and the grass is wet, etc., etc. I had to prove something, and then, in front of you, I showed a whole bunch of resolutions. Finally, I got an empty class, and you are happy. Okay. The question is, it sort of becomes much harder to control the search in the full resolution, which is not surprising because full resolution actually leads to an NP-complete search. Okay. So, just to get an idea of how full resolution search works, and first of all, to realize that theorem proving involves search is itself an important point. Because until now, we assume that if you are trying to do search, you can do theorem proving. In Davis-Putnam procedure, if you're trying to do search for a model, involved trying to prove that the partial model you have on your hand probably is not worth it, so that you can backtrack. So search involves theorem proving. Okay, model finding involves theorem proving. But theorem proving also involves search. Okay, so for example, if I start having, let's say, how does search go in resolution? If I have a database, then I convert it into causal form. Okay, then I take the goal, negate it, and then convert it into causal form. This, by the way, is very important. You first negate the goal and then convert it into the causal form, and then add it to the knowledge base. Okay, because it's what you're trying to prove is if you take the negation of the goal and add it to the database, then it is becoming inconsistent. Now you have a new database, which is the original database DO plus DG, which is set of clauses that you got just by negating the goal. Okay? Now you start with this database and you go into a loop where select any pair of clauses C1 and C2 from this database D, resolve them. If you resolve them, then add the resolution. So resolve C1 and C2 to get C12, which is a new clause. Add C12 to the database. In fact, if C12 is empty clause, then you're done. If the C12 is empty clause, then you're done. If not, you add it to the database and then check, you know, get another pair of clauses and then resolve them until you have, you know, you get an empty clause. That's what you're doing in trying to do this, you know, a proof, which is why it's painful to do it in, you know, limited time with anything other than a reasonably sized, you know, 3-4 sentences database. Okay.
Could you do an example?
We just did it last time, but I'll show you again. Okay. But the let me see. I think I removed that from this one. Oh, by the way, I hope you are keeping track of I wind up sometimes adding slides that didn't exist before, so you should be looking at them. But this was the example that we did last time, right? And we basically converted them into clausal form. First, we wrote them into propositional logic, converted them into the clausal form, and then what we are trying to prove was grass is not wet. So you wanted to prove not GW. So you took the negation of it, added to the database, it's GW. Now I kept making new clauses. So original database is this, DG is this, so DG plus DC is this, the whole thing in blue. Now I did a resolution between those two, I got an extra clause, that too is part of the database now. Anything I proved is now becoming part of my database. Now I did a resolution between this, the next time I picked this and this, so the new pair I picked is this and this. Okay, and then I pick this and this, then I pick that and that, and that and that, and that and that, and that and that, and I'm done. That was one proof. Okay, one set of, a pair of clauses that I kept resolving until I got an empty clause. Okay, now keep that in mind. We'll come back to it in a minute again. So the idea is, I said basically in this thing, I can pick any pair of clauses C1 and C2 from the database and resolve them. The question, of course, is if you're trying to guide the search, the real question becomes which pair of clauses are you going to pick? That's the biggest question. Okay? One important thing that you have to understand is if you think of theorem proving as a search and if you're trying to do A star search on it, it looks as if when you have a database D, should you not consider for every pair P1, P2, should you not consider every pair as a new child generator? So if for every pair of clauses that you can prove a theorem, right? So you could do P1, P2, these are C1 and C2. If I do C1 and C2, I will get D plus C1, 2. If I do C2, C3, I get D plus C2, 3, and so on. It looks as if the normal search would be, I have to consider all the children at this level. Then for each of the children, I consider their children at the next level, and so on. But the way I wrote this algorithm, I'm only picking one pair. So I'm basically saying, pick some particular pair, let's say this one, and don't even consider these. Do you lose anything? The order is not important. It's exactly like the CSP. The variable, you know, it looks as if in the normal CSP, you should consider setting each variable in the one level and then again setting all each variable remaining in the next level. But we argued to ourselves that the order in which you set the variables does not lead to loss of completeness. It does lead to efficiency versus inefficiency, but ultimately everybody needs to be set. Just a second. Another point of that, in this kind of scenarios, what you have is something called a commutative system. A commutative system is one where if you ignore all these guys, the biggest worry when you have multiple things that you need to do and you need to pick one is, can I do the things that I'm not doing right now little later? In normal life, the choices that you have, once you pick this choice, the other choice may never again come your way. In normal search, that can happen. But in theorem proving, every choice, let's say if you only pick this and you didn't do this resolution, C1, C2, you can still do it after coming here. So every choice that was available to you before is still available to you. That's why the order, you don't ever have to backtrack on which choice you picked. Those are called commutative systems. In CSP, it's the same reason. You know, the variable that you set, if you set variable V1 first, you can still set variable V2 later. It's not that you will not be able to do it. Okay? So that's the big thing that we already did here. But even after that, you still have to decide which particular pair are you going to pick. Yes? Basically, the way I wrote this here, it's a complete search strategy. The question is, which pair of, what is the control rule for picking a pair of clauses?
But there's not like a way to just go down one branch and still exhaust all possibilities.
You can go through one branch, yes. But the point is, a branch is having done all these things, but you still, at every point, you have to consider which pair you're going to pick. Okay? Now, let me give you example ideas. Idea one is an idea. So remember that if the database has, you know, n clauses, then there are n square of order of n square pairs of clauses. Okay? So instead of looking at all those pairs of clauses, idea one is to assume that if there is going to be an empty clause, it must have something to do with the goal. It's reasonable to assume that the database is consistent to begin with. So if there's going to be an empty clause, it must be something to do with the fact that the goal, negation of the goal, winds up deriving the empty clause from the rest of the clauses. Okay? Which means that one of the clauses should always be either the goal clause itself or somebody which was derived by resolving a goal clause with some other clause. Okay, so of the two clauses that you ever resolve, make sure that at least one of them is either the goal clause itself or a clause that is derived by taking a goal clause with some other clause. So either you are connected, so you're connected to the goalness. Okay, either your goal clause itself or you are child of a goal clause by resolution. Now, in the example that I showed you, surprisingly enough, that's exactly what we did. In the example that I showed you, you notice that I started, the first pair was goal clause and somebody else. And now, this is set of support. This has set of support because it's a goal clause. Now, this one is a child of a goal clause because it was resolved with goal clause and somebody else. So the next resolution I did was between this and some other clause. The third resolution I did was between this and some other clause. And then the fourth is this and some other clause. Okay, so there is, in fact, you'll notice that here, every resolution I did, one of the clauses was either the goal clause or something that was derived from the goal clause. This cuts down the number of choices you're considering.
So it's much more like pure
planning. No, it's not. It's a complete search strategy. I am basically saying, even though you would think you would need to consider order of n square pairs to prove the empty clause, you actually know that if your original database was consistent, then the only way that empty clause could come is that, you know, remember that original database was D plus DG, right? I think DC plus DG. And one of the clauses must be from DG, one must be from DC, so that you can get an empty clause.
Okay.
question is, what is most constrained? Think about what is most constrained here. Okay? It's a very good question, but think about it. So, that's one choice, and in fact, I did this here without telling you. See, for example, I did not just randomly resolve these two. I couldn't have resolved those two, but I could have resolved these two, for example. And if I resolve these two, then I have done at least one resolution which is not set of support resolution. Okay. Now it turns out that set of support is a complete strategy. In the sense, if you only do these resolutions all the time, you will still be complete. Okay? That means any theorem that can be proved will be proved by just doing this. And idea two is a more aggressive idea. It says linear input form, which is either C1 or C2 must be from the original set of classes. Okay? So original set of classes was the theory and the goal class, you know, negated. So you would say that one of the two classes should always be the input classes. That means the ones that came as part of the knowledge base are the goal class. If you do that, you have much fewer combinations, because remember that as you keep doing resolutions, newer classes are coming, more and more of them are coming. But none of them ever, you can never do resolution between two classes which are both new. I'm allowing that in the previous case, because at least one of them must be a goal or a goal-derived class. So this does allow two classes which are goal-derived to be resolved. Here I won't allow that. This cuts down the number of classes, the number of combinations you consider significantly. This is called linear input form strategy. But it's not complete. It turns out that there are theorems that can be proved that if you only do these resolutions, you will never prove them. Okay? So again, think of these as heuristics, just like the A-star search heuristics. These are the heuristics for this particular form of search. These are the ordering heuristics. These are more closer to the CSP heuristics. Okay? So the bigger issue, of course, is it's search. And if you do any of this is called a set of support idea, and if you do that, you are complete. Now compare this to this top-down strategy that I told you about with modus ponens. That's so much simpler, because you know that you're trying to prove a theorem. In support of that theorem, you would then work on a rule which then gives the sub-theorems to be proved and so on. Okay, so modus ponens is much more straightforward to understand, but you know, this one too can be written as a search strategy, and this will give you the full propositional theorem proving. Question.
You can only add one new clause each time. Isn't it possible that it would fail unless you added more than one?
What? No, okay. Stop there. The huge big point here is this is all in the robot's head, not on the real world. There is no time step that is connected to the real world. All I'm saying is I'm organizing my search in this way. Okay? I could do the entire search within one time step if I have a fast search. So the point is not that I do one resolution, take a step in the real world, then do the second resolution, take a step in the real world. This has no connection to that. This is all in my head. Search happens in my head. Of course, if the search is taking forever and the trucks are coming at me, I will have to start taking steps. And that's a much harder issue as to how much theorem proving would you do trying to prove to yourself that I am safe while the truck is coming at you, right? Before, say, to heck with the theorem prover, let me just jump and get out of the truck's way. Okay, that's a bigger issue, but that's combining inference with execution. This is all in inference level. This is all in the robot's head.
What I mean is that if you had a rule that would fail, that would to be proved by including it, but that a pair of rules would succeed,
I need to get an example of that.
Yeah,
let's take it offline. Try to think of one, and then I'll try to explain to you how you are wrong, because you have to be. You know, the question is, it's still worth knowing where the fallacy is. You know, it's like there are all these math fallacies, right? I mean, I can always show you that I can get 1 equal to 0, and it's interesting to see where the reasoning went wrong, because it's, you know, we know that 1 cannot be equal to 0, so the question is, where did we go wrong? Anyway, this is not moving any further. Okay, okay. Now what? And remember that since you would be doing this interactively, you know, if you're doing it on an example, especially on time class, you know, under time pressures, you are desperately trying to materialize an empty class out of nowhere. And I mentioned last class some of the obvious mistakes that people do, you know, which, you know, like for example, you cannot resolve PRQ with not PRQ to get empty class. In fact, they are not inconsistent. Okay, so if this PRQ and this not P are not Q, they are not inconsistent. PRQ is inconsistent with not P and not Q. But it's not inconsistent with not P or not Q. Okay? But you try to say, yeah, this is, these two can be dissolved with these two, and that's not resolution rule. Resolution rule picks one literal in each class such that they are negations of each other and removes them. Okay? And also you should start having everything in the result in the CNF clauses. Before you resolve, goal must be negated first before it's converted into CNF form, and those are things that you should keep in mind just from the point of view of making sure that you're doing the resolution correctly. Yes, sir?
Can you relate this to a real-world example? Like, I'm having trouble with what is the difference between search versus theorem proving?
Theorem proving is essentially trying, so you can think of this resolution as a search process, right? So each node is a database. Okay, the children of a database are generated by picking a pair of classes from the database, resolving them, adding it back to the database. That's a new child now. Okay, so search is a very general idea. In fact, resolution is just, you know, the search model can also capture the resolution, the theorem proving. The issue here is, in theorem proving, the search comes because you're trying to prove that something is true by doing a repeated set of resolutions that will ultimately end in an empty class. Okay, ultimately end in an empty class. And the question is, there is a search involved because many of the resolutions may not have anything to do with the empty class. Right, because that was the point I was making last time with that Sherlock Holmes joke. Because many, many things can be proved, but what you are trying to prove is the theorem that I asked you to prove. Okay, everything resolution says is true, but that's just because it's true doesn't mean it's relevant to what you are trying to prove. Okay,
like a real world example where
you can go back to the textbook and look at, for example, there's a whole thing on the what he calls the Wampus domain. If you consider that to be a real world example, you might want to look at that. Okay, I mean the stuff that I showed you earlier, the example on rain and wet grass, that's an example. And in fact, I just showed you one path which leads me to prove that the grass is wet. Okay, but in fact, there are many other paths that won't lead me to prove anything. And I had to find the path that actually does prove me. Okay, and that was the search. I did this, you know, normally when I show you a search problem and ask you to show that there's a solution, you just show me one solution by figuring it out. But a program has to look at all possible dead ends and pick the right solution. Okay, so that's where the search comes. Solving problems using propositional logic, you need to write everything that you know as propositional formulas. And the theorem proving will then try to tell you whether a given new sentence will hold given what you know in the database. And there are three kinds of queries that you could ask your database. One is my knowledge base consistent to begin with? My knowledge base is consistent if it exists, it has at least one model. This is basically satisfiability problem. The other is the sentence S entailed by knowledge base, which is the one that we spent all our time on. S is entailed, if you negate S and add it to the knowledge base, then you should be able to derive an empty class. Okay? So this is the usual theorem proving, this is just knowledge base consistency check. And the third thing is the sentence S consistent with my knowledge base? It's not entailed, but is it consistent? This is an interesting question. So if I implicitly already believed negation of S, then believing S makes me blow up. So before I add S to my knowledge base, I might want to ask myself, is adding S consistent with the rest of my belief? Okay? What that means then is S is consistent if not S is not entailed. That's what it is. So if you're allowed to add S to the database and still keep it consistent if you cannot prove not S. Okay? Notice that proving not S, would that have meant that, you know, the idea is that as long as your belief system has not constrained you into believing not S, you're allowed to add S to the database. That's all I'm saying. Okay? So that's the consistency. So these are three different kinds of questions you can ask. All of them become either entailment check or satisfiability check. Okay? Now, one thing, of course, is propositional logic is good in what it does, but it does not differentiate between degrees of truth and a bunch of other things. So we will look at some examples. Okay? Example one is a simple example. Pearl lives in Los Angeles. It's a high crime area. Pearl installed a burglar alarm. He asked his neighbors, John and Mary, to call him if they hear the alarm. This way he can come home if there's a burglary. Los Angeles is also earthquake prone. So alarm goes off when there is an earthquake. You heard the story now, right? This is a Pearl story. So the question is, how do I write this in my knowledge base? Here, burglary implies alarm. Earthquake implies alarm. Alarm implies John calls. Alarm implies Mary calls. Then given this, I can ask the kinds of questions. Is there a burglary? If there is a burglary, will Mary call? So the question is, KB and B should imply M. This should not be E, it should be B. Okay, that's what I prove. I'm trying to prove to myself, based on what I know, if there is a burglary, will Mary definitely call? And that would be to show that KB and B would entail M. Okay? Also, if Mary didn't call, is it possible that burglary occurred? Is it possible that burglary occurred? Well, that is essentially check KB and not M doesn't entail not B. Okay? So I'm just telling you that you can use your propositional logical database to answer these kinds of questions. Right? And so I wrote what I knew and I'm able to answer this question in propositional logic. Okay? So far, so good. The question, of course, is the Pearl lives in not the fake Los Angeles that I made up, but in real Los Angeles. Okay? Real Los Angeles is close to fake Los Angeles, but it has the following other issues. Burglars can sometimes disable alarms. Okay? Some earthquakes may be too slight to cause alarm to go off. Okay? Even in Los Angeles, burglaries are more likely than earthquakes. Okay. John and Mary both have their own lives, surprisingly enough, and they may not always call when the alarm goes off. And between John and Mary, John is more of a slacker than Mary. Yeah, it's always that way. And then John and Mary may call even when there is no alarm going off because they are friends. They once in a while want to call. This is real world. Okay. My question is, how do I handle real Pearl in my propositional logic database? Okay? There are two ways of handling this. Way one is the eager way, which is model everything. Okay? So model exactly the conditions under which John will call. So you keep pestering him until he gives every possible thing, okay? So I will call if there is an earthquake and I'm not in the middle of my pancake eating and there is no dog chasing me and something else and something else, something else, then I will call. And if not, then also I'll call under these other conditions. I'll also call under these other conditions. So I have to make every possible precondition be present in what I write. Furthermore, John can actually have, you know, how many of you have seen the movie Brazil? Yes, sad people. So there is a beautiful scene there where this lady is getting, you know, plastic surgery done, and this is like a running gag through the whole movie, and this lady is getting plastic surgery done. Every time she comes, she is full of bandages off her face because the plastic surgery is still taking off. And somewhere after the second half, first half of the movie, she still has these bandages, and she starts saying, my complications are having complications. So the first she had problems, so she had plastic surgery. Plastic surgery gave complications, so some more time. And then after a while, complications started having their own complications. Okay? In this case too, every exception might have its own exception as to when John calls or whether John calls or not calls. Every rule that John will give as to when they will call probably is defeatable. And if you push them, if you pester them more, they'll say, yeah, there is an exception here. It's true that when I'm eating, you know, pancakes, normally I don't feel like calling everybody. But, you know, if I'm eating pancakes with maple syrup, I hate maple syrup, so I'm trying to get out of my pancakes, so I won't mind calling them. So that's an extra exception. Except maple syrup from, you know, Vermont, because that I really like to do, so I don't want to get up. Although if it's in a particular county of Vermont, I don't like, you know. So you can keep going into these exceptions, exceptions, exceptions. So you can do this, but it's impossible to do. Okay? But if you do model everything, then you can write it in propositional logic, or, you know, of course, if you have objects, you can write in first order logic, and you'll be fine. If not, and in particular, basically, if you do it this way, then the logic will still be monotonic, because everything that you prove will remain true as you learn more and more. Okay? The other way is the ignorant and lazy way, which is, I'll write rules and knowing fully well that all the rules are fake, okay, that they're actually not completely true. Okay? So basically, I need to be able to write a rule which models the likelihood of that rule actually being true. So it doesn't have to be true in all worlds. It's probably true in only some percentage of worlds. And it's only true everything else being normal, which is the classic thing that we did, right? When I say Tweety is a bird, everything else being normal, Tweety flies. And then I say Tweety is an ostrich, and you say, ostriches are not normal. You know, they are abnormal birds. So that's why normality has fallen apart, and so Tweety doesn't fly anymore. And then I say Tweety is a magical ostrich. Magical ostriches are not normal, even compared to ostriches. Okay? I mean, as ostriches go, magical ostriches are abnormality there. So then you again go back and say they can fly. Okay? So basically, you could either consider these non-monotonic logics, where you essentially realize that every rule is holding only when certain abnormal conditions don't hold. Okay? And use that to, you know, formalize this whole thing. Or essentially, you can use probability theory. So you can say this rule holds with this much probability. Now the problem, of course, is to do it correctly with probability theory is trickier than you might consider. Okay? Because you cannot actually give probabilities for each rule separately. So suppose one of the issues is, if I say A implies B, let's say, right, in a propositional logic sense, if I know that A is true, then B is true with full probability, essentially. It's definitely true. Okay? So take something like this rule. Okay? If I ask you, and if I say, if A is true and A and B is true, is B true? Okay? And similarly, if B is true and A and B is true, is A true? Now, propositional logic is very simple. It'll say, this I can answer, this I won't answer. Okay? Now I say A implies B 0.7. That means A implies B in 70% of the world where A is true, B is also true. Other 30%, God knows what happens. Now the question, of course, is if A is true and A implies B is B true? Yeah, sort of, with some probability. Now, similarly, if B is true and A implies B is true, is A true? Yeah, sort of, because, you know, B, one way B gets caused is by A. So if you know that B occurred, your belief that A occurred increases. You cannot be sure that A occurred, but your belief in A increases. Right? Now, how do I make sure that I don't go into a cycle with this, both these rules? Now I'm allowing with A, and A implies B, I'm able to prove B, which now I can push into this and increase my belief in A, which I can push into this and increase my belief in B, which would be nonsensical. Okay? So what happens essentially is, when you have to consider probabilistic reasoning, you have to consider, there are normal ways of doing it, which is if you have n variables, let's say n propositional variables, you have to consider the joint probability distribution over those n propositional variables. Okay? Once you do joint probability distribution, the rules of probability, the elementary rules of probability, conditional probabilities and all that stuff will just tell you, will make sure that you won't ever go into cycles. Okay? The reason the cycling issue is important is because before you went here, as I said last time, people tried to do this sort of, each rule has its own number sort of a deal. Each rule has its own number sort of a deal, and that got them into all sorts of semantic issues because they can go into cycles in reasoning. Okay? So, this is my last, probably the big slide that I'll do today, which is sort of an overall view of what the everything that we'll do in probabilistic propositional logic. Okay? So suppose we know the likelihood of each of the propositional worlds. Suppose I have P1 to PN as my propositions, then true false values to each of them will become a full world. Now, in propositional logic, each world was sort of, you didn't talk about likelihood of the worlds, okay? But suppose I actually know the likelihood each of the propositional worlds, which essentially is the joint probability distribution. If you have n variables, okay? So if I have, for example, two variables, A and B, what does the joint probability distribution of A and B look like? If I have A here, can be true or false, and then B can also be true or false. Okay? Then a joint probability distribution tells me what is the probability that A and B are true. A is false, B is true. A is true, B is false. A is false, B is false. Those actually are the worlds. If you think of A and B as propositions, there are four worlds. What joint probability distribution tells you is what is the likelihood of each of those worlds, such that the adding up of all the likelihoods will give you 1.0. That's the, you know, if you're thinking of discrete probabilities, discrete variables, that's the bedrock of probability theory. Okay? Once I have joint probability distribution, I can answer any question that you can throw at me using these variables. Any question. You can decide whichever you want. You know, I'll answer that for you. Okay, so for example, you can ask me what's the probability that A and B is true. You can ask me what's the probability that A implies B is true. What's the probability that B implies A is true. Any propositional sentence you can ask me. You can even ask me questions such as, if I just found out, if I don't know anything, what's the probability of it? What's the probability that in a random world that I pick, A is true? Okay? And also, if I happen to know B is true, what's the probability of A? Which is, that would only be considering the two worlds where B is true. Right? This is all elementary probability theory. So, all I want actually is joint probability distribution. Once I have joint probability distribution, I contend that you did probability statistics in your life at some point of time, and you know how to combine joint probability to answer any query on the variables. That's it. That's the theory of probabilistic reasoning. What's the problem with it? It looks as if we are done even faster than propositional logic. Okay, so basically joint probability distribution is all that you need. So the question is, I'm sorry, there is a color here that you are not able to see. So the question is, if I do get this, I would be able to solve every possible query. There's only one problem, just one problem. The problem is who makes up the numbers. In all your life, when you are sitting in these elementary probability classes, you never asked who made up these numbers. Because I am the professor, I make up the numbers, I make you chunk it through, right? Who gives you these numbers? Okay. If there are n propositional variables, do you know how many numbers do you need? You need the entire joint probability distribution. That is 2 power n numbers. Well, you can be strict and say, well, it's not exactly 2 power n, it's 2 power n minus 1. Because if I give you everything but 1, then you can add them all up, subtract it from 1, you'll get the last one. Okay. But that doesn't really save you, right? So if this n is, let's say, 10, then you're talking about 1024 minus 1, so 1023 probabilities. The question is, where do you get this? The biggest question in reasoning with uncertainty is not so much as to how to crunch the number. It is important. But the much bigger issue is, where do you get the number? Okay? So, since getting numbers is the hardest part, let's think of, so all that we will learn in probabilistic reasoning in this class is how to reduce the number of numbers that I need to assess. You know, this is, I use the word assessment, okay? 2 power n numbers are needed. If you are an agent, you need 2 power n numbers. Who's going to give it to you? Either the guy who wrote your program, or you go, whoever wrote that program has to go and assess these 2 power n numbers. Now, of course, you can say, well, let's assume everything is equally likely. It'll become easier. Okay, but that's not solving the problem. It's just you're hoping to make your life simple, you are wishing away the reality. Some words are, in fact, more likely than others. So the question is, without ignoring the reality, how do I make sure, how do I reduce the number of numbers I need to provide so that I can do this reasoning? The answer is that all of what we learn in probabilistic reasoning in this class is that we will talk about, if I happen to know that certain dependencies hold locally between variables, then those dependencies will wind up constraining the possible joint probability distributions that are actually consistent. Okay, so if I have A, B, right, two variables, okay, if I asked you what are the possible joint distributions for A, B, how many possible joint distributions are there? How many possible joint distributions are there between A and B? How many possible worlds are there for A and B? 4. How many possible joint distributions are there for A and B? What? Infinity. Infinity. Because all you need is 4 real numbers that add up to 1. 4 real numbers can add up to 1 in infinite number of ways. I mean, 4 positive real numbers that add up to 1. They're infinite number of ways. So, if I just tell you A and B are, you know, two variables, how many joint distributions are there? Infinite number of them. If I tell you A and B are joint distribution, joint variables, and A strictly implies B. A strictly implies B. It reduces the number of joint distributions that you can write. Agreed? Because the world where A is true and B is false has to have a zero in it. Agreed? Okay? The other worlds can still have any number, but the world where A is true, B is false now must have a zero in it. So you have reduced the number of joint distributions that are consistent. what knowledge about the interdependencies between variables tells you is it constrains the joint distribution. And it can reduce the number of actual numbers you have to assess now. Okay? In particular, this is what's called a Bayes network. We'll look at it more as classes go on. But what I would do in Bayes networks is I take the causal theory, which sort of holds with lots of exceptions. So burglary sort of causes alarm, earthquake sort of causes alarm, alarm sort of makes John call, alarm sort of makes Mary call. Everything has exceptions. So I write my Bayes network with burglary, alarm, John calls, Mary calls, earthquake. There are five variables. And then I will essentially notice that for each of these connections, I put a connection there. Burglary causes alarm, earthquake can cause alarm, alarm can cause John calls, alarm can cause Mary calls. This is the causal theory of this domain. Because this causal theory is there, it turns out that normally for five variables, how many numbers do you need to provide the joint distribution of the five variables? 2^5 - 1, 31 numbers. If this joint distribution holds, then how many numbers do I need? What basically Bayes network tells you is all you need to do is for each of these nodes provide a conditional probability table of that node taking the value true versus false given the values of its parents. So for this guy there are no parents, so probability of burglary true given nothing, and probability of burglary true, burglary false given nothing. So if I, those two have to add up to one, so I can just give probability of burglary here. And then here probability of earthquake. By the time I come here, notice what happens. Alarm has two parents, burglary and earthquake. Both of them try to cause it. But they could be causing it in such a way that they increase the probability, they could be causing in such a way that if one is causing it, another is actually undoing it. So all I need is this table. What is the probability that alarm is true when burglary is true, earthquake is true, burglary is true, earthquake is false, burglary is false, earthquake is true, and both are false. Those are the four numbers I need. Notice that because I required this, I never wrote a single rule saying earthquake causes alarm with 0.9 probability, burglary causes alarm with 0.7 probability. I essentially told you how alarm is together caused by burglary and earthquake. That's what my CPT is. And for this guy, John calls when alarm is true, John calls when alarm is false, Mary calls when alarm is true, Mary calls when alarm is false. How many total numbers are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Instead of 31 numbers, I only need 10 numbers. What would be the world where you would need the truly least number of numbers for these five variables? Give me a Bayes network configuration where you would need the least number of numbers.
The straight
line, each equation. No. So one idea would be that somehow, you know, if I have five variables, A1 is causing, A2 is causing, A3 is causing, A4 is causing, A5. How many numbers do you need here? 1 here, 2 here, 2 here, 2 here, 2 here. Agreed? So that would be 3, 5, 7, 9. Not much lower than 10. What is the Bayes network that will require the least number of probabilities?
Every variable is dependent only one variable.
Why? Somebody should be awake. You get to go home once you answer this question. Think about this.
If it's not connected.
Yes, if it's not connected. So here is my network, A1, A2, A3, A4, A5. How many numbers do I need now?
Five.
That's it. Would you like to live in this world as against that world? Would you like to live in a world where the least number of probabilities are needed to specify the world? You have to hate living in this world. This is a great world for your program because the program only needs five numbers. If nothing you do is connected to anything else that happens, why live? Right? You may as well be a big eggplant, a nice vegetable, and sit around. Okay? So dependencies are what makes world controllable. Because burglary and earthquake, you know, influence alarm, and alarm influences John and Mary, you can control the world through these dependencies. If there are no dependencies, the world is uncontrollable. It's a great world in terms of your probability numbers, the number of numbers you need, but it's an ugly world in terms of controllability. But on the other hand, so there are two extremes, okay? One where everything in your life is disconnected with everything else in your life. The other extreme, everything you do is connected to everything else. Both are bad. What we hope is somewhere here, somewhere in here, in between, where some of the things we do connect to some of the things that, you know, in the world. So dependencies are important, but too much of a good thing can be bad. Just because you're unhappy with dependencies, if you remove all of them, you will need fewer probabilities, but that would be a really bad world to live in. So all we're going to do essentially is take a theory, write its causal form, which is what causes what, convert it into a graphical model. This is a Bayes network in this case. And the graphical model then tells you what are the actual number of probabilities that you need to assess. These are all conditional probabilities. Then you have Bayes network. Then you can, given this Bayes network, I can reconstruct the joint probability distribution. And once I have the joint probability distribution, I can answer any query. The rest of the 1.5 classes on this topic would be why all of this makes sense and how to do this computation faster. Okay? That's right.